You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Chuck Farrer, former U.S. Navy SEAL and the author of SEAL Target Geronimo, the inside story of the mission to kill Osama bin Laden. Chuck, thanks for joining us today.
Sir, it is a great pleasure to be here. Thanks for talking to me.
Is it okay if I refer to you as Chuck or Mr. Farrer?
You know what? I really prefer Chuck because Mr. Farr generally means I'm in trouble.
Thanks, Chuck. Chuck, I want to, of course, get into the book because it really was terrific. It reads like a Tom Clancy novel. I'm not really much of a fiction reader, pretty much only read nonfiction. And of course, this book was nonfiction, but it's like a nonfiction fiction book. It was amazing. But before we get into the book, for the benefit of the listeners, can you let them know a little bit about who you are?
Well, I always go back to, in a previous life, I was a naval special warfare officer myself, kind of an odd family. My family is Swiss. We've been in the United States four generations, and I am the third generation of that family to be a naval officer. I graduated myself from BUDS way back in 1981. I served at SEAL Team 4 in Central America. I was the executive officer of the SEAL detachment assigned to the multinational peacekeeping force in Beirut, Lebanon, during the Lebanese Civil War. I witnessed the Marine barracks bombing and the French Foreign Legion bombing and the bombing of the American Embassy there in Lebanon. Afterwards, I served as the Caribbean Contingency Commander for Naval Special Warfare. I served in Honduras and El Salvador throughout the Caribbean. Then I was transferred to Naval Special Warfare Development Group, also known as SEAL Team 6, where I eventually served as the Red Squadron Commander, an Assault Element Commander, and was there that I left the service. I continued in the reserve for 15 years after that. On the civilian side, I have had a checkered career as an author and a novelist, and God help me, a Hollywood screenwriter. Those are the things that will happen to you if you don't pay attention in school, kids.
Let's just talk about, before we get into the book. Oh, by the way, let me just, for the benefit of the listeners, you said BUDS, and of course, there are a lot of acronyms and there's a lot of terms that people should become familiar with to understand what we're talking about. And of course, we don't have the time to go over all of them. But when you get the book, listeners, SEAL Target Geronimo by Chuck Farrer, in the back there is a glossary. And BUDS stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training. And that's something that I want to touch on in a little bit, about how brutal that is. But you said that you are an author and a screenwriter, and can you just tell the listeners a little bit about some of your work, what you've done?
When I got out of the Navy, oddly enough, I was going to go to medical school. I thought I was going to become a psychiatrist, which is sort of, I guess that says something about myself. I thought very strangely that I had sold a screenplay while I was in the Navy. I thought, well, I'll just write another screenplay to help pay for medical school. Medical school wasn't in my future, but I wound up doing a couple of movies. I did Navy SEALs. I did Hard Target. I did Red Planet, Dark Man for Sam Raimi, and I did The Jackal. Let's see, a couple other movies that are not as good or notable. I started writing books. In the early 2000s, I wrote an autobiography called Warrior Soul, the memoir of a Navy SEAL. I wrote a novel called Killing Che, which was a barely fictionized account of the American effort to track and kill Ernesto Che Guevara in Bolivia in 1967. And my most recent book is SEAL Target Geronimo, Inside the Mission to Kill Osama bin Laden. It's a nonfiction book, and it accounts the recent SEAL team raid on Abbottabad, Pakistan, to take out bin Laden.
That's pretty cool. You sold a screenplay while you were in the Navy.
You know, it was interesting. When I was in graduate school, I met a really unique Renaissance character, a guy named Richard Murphy, who had come out to Los Angeles. I was going to school at Northridge in L.A. And Murph was literally the kind of guy who came out to Los Angeles to break into screen biz. And we wrote a screenplay together that didn't really go anywhere. I wound up joining the Navy literally while I was stationed in Beirut. We corresponded, sending each other scenes and portions of a screenplay. When I got back from Beirut, it was optioned. So there for a while, I was the only Navy SEAL in the world with a William Morris agent.
That's great.
I kept writing in what was my spare time during my naval career and was lucky or unlucky enough to have landed into a career in Hollywood after I got out of the Navy.
Well, I'm sure luck had something to do with it, but obviously you can write. I just read your book, so don't sell yourself so short there, Chuck. You're a great writer.
Thank you very much, but it's I think writing is like being a fisherman. You know, you can go out on a nice, clear, calm day and fill your boat up with fish, or you can go out and get clobbered and come back with nothing, or not come back at all. It's a job that really keeps you humble, I think, and it's like respecting the sea. I think you'll have a longer career the more humble and contrite you stay.
Right.
You know, there's always something to learn, and you have to remain open to learning it and putting it together.
I couldn't agree with you more about that. I do a lot of writing myself.
You know it.
Yeah, I do. Your latest book, as you mentioned, of course, Seal Target Geronimo. On page 25, you're talking about something called Hell Week. I want to give the audience a little bit of understanding about what these people go through to become SEALs. I mean, I've known SEALs in my Navy career, but I never knew what they went through. And let me read this right here. The survivors, this is, of course, of something called Hell Week, look like shipwreck victims. Their uniforms are torn, and their feet are so blistered and ulcerated that a class can be tracked by the bloody footprints left by its members. By Saturday morning, some men can no longer walk without support. Some have hands and feet that are swollen like balloons, and others are sunburned beyond recognition, the skin on their faces peeling off in sheets. Now, Chuck, let me ask you this. Did you embellish this in any way?
No, that pretty much describes my class when we were secured on Saturday morning. The Navy advertises it as a course that is physically and mentally challenging, which is an atypical Navy understatement. Only the Navy can understate things like that. Hell Week is either the fourth or sixth week of the first phase of training, and I say fourth or sixth because there is a period of pre-training now that they put on in front of it. It runs from Sunday night to Saturday morning. It's a week during which you are given no more than 4 hours of sleep. It's funny, in going through there with a degree in psychology, I realized that the time they were allowing us to, quote, sleep, unquote, were very cleverly timed to try to put you into a REM state as quickly as possible and yank you out of it so you would be even more disoriented when you woke up. They run you through a constant list of evolutions, running, swimming, diving, paddling your boat. They're all sort of team sports. You're grouped together into boat crews. The boat crews compete against each other. And the losing boat crews are given even more things to do and more punishment, as it were. It's not unusual to lose 60% of the guys will volunteer to quit during this period. It's the crucible through which every prospective Navy SEAL is put. It really tests you more mentally than anything. The physical demands are such that I think every SEAL who's gone through it will tell you that the physical demands become irrelevant because everyone hurts. Everyone has been asked to do more than they thought was physically possible. Everyone is suffering. You just have to be able to put the pain in a different place in your mind and continue on through it, which is really what the Navy's looking for. The purpose of all this punishment is to find men who are able to compartmentalize suffering and continue on through it. In other words, to separate the will from the body.
Right. Almost like Zen, like you mentioned in the book.
Exactly. I think there's much in common with what a Zen monk is trying to do between what he feels and what he's capable of doing himself. It's very similar.
So a prospective candidate, the physical requirement isn't all that matters. You could be rough and tough and be able to paddle twice as far as someone else, but you also need to mentally compartmentalize this stuff. Is that what you're saying?
Right, exactly. You'll find in a BUDS class, if you've got someone who shows up the MVP kind of athlete, you know, a guy with all kinds of trophies and everything else, who has found that he's been sort of a pampered racehorse all his athletic career, they tend not to do as well as the guy who just barely made the varsity.
Right.
Because one guy's a racehorse and the other guy's a warhorse.
Right.
And it takes the kind of guy who keeps charging. Also, I think if you're a guy who always won the Heisman, you're used to winning all the time. You're used to being fussed over. And if you're another kind of guy, you face defeat, you move on. The program is looking for people who are resilient. Believe me, the instructors know how to knock you on your butt, and they'll make sure that everybody gets put there. What they're looking for is guys that can remain positive and keep doing it. As we were talking earlier, it's one of the only schools in the military where the officers and the enlisted men undergo the exact same curriculum together. In the Army Special Forces program, there is an officer's course and an enlisted course, and they are separate.
Mm-hmm.
In BUDS, the officers and the enlisted guys go through together in the boat crews. This fosters a very, very close bond between officers and enlisted guys. In the SEALs, so much so that it's pretty much a first-name basis outfit. And if anything, it's harder to get through BUDS as an officer because the instructors don't expect you to just survive. They expect the officers to thrive. And they expect the officers to lead. And if not lead physically, then they certainly must lead morally. There's a lot on any young man who takes this on, but I think every BUDS graduate, every SEAL will tell you that the game is mostly fought in your head.
Yeah, I did read that part about what happened to the officers who couldn't make it through the training. It seemed a rather ignominious ending to their careers.
because the officers and the enlisted go through together, and the instructors are principally enlisted SEALs, very experienced guys, the case could be made that the enlisted men in the SEAL teams choose their officers. It's the enlisted instructors who look very closely at every officer who tries to come across the threshold. And the imperious, the impulsive, the idiotic, these are guys who are not going to wind up becoming officers in the SEAL team.
Right.
But I can tell you this, they're willing to mold and they're willing to teach. And young officer particularly has got to be willing to listen. There is a great bit of corporate knowledge in this community, and it is held in the hands of senior enlisted. I think as a Navy guy yourself, you know that the backbone of the Navy is its enlisted and its senior enlisted guys.
Sure.
It's the same in BUDS. It's a privilege to lead these men, and that's something you have to earn. You'll be given your commission, but you've got to earn the respect of your teammates if you expect to be an officer in the SEAL teams.
Right. And of course, you were an officer. You were not enlisted.
I was a cake eater, as they say.
Well, let me just talk a little bit about the SEALs here. On page 11, you say that the smallest and most elite special operations unit in the world is SEAL Team 6. On page 37, you say that SEAL Team 6 was and is on the highest alert of any unit in the U.S. military. Of course, in the book, you go through the history of the SEALs, and I gained a lot of knowledge from reading that. Of course, there are certain events that occurred throughout history that had a great impact on the evolution of the SEALs and SEAL Team 6. On page 43, you talk about, as you mentioned earlier, you were in Beirut, Lebanon, when that truck bomb went off. I guess that was October 23rd of 1983, and you say on page 43, and of course, 243 American Marines were murdered that day. You say that the bomb that took out the Marine Battalion Landing Team headquarters in Beirut was the largest non-nuclear explosion in the history of warfare. I wasn't aware of that. Can you tell the listeners, Chuck, why was this event significant to the evolution of the SEALs and SEAL Team 6?
Well, I could tell you just a little bit of background. The multinational peacekeeping force was inserted into Lebanon in 1982. There was a previous peacekeeping force inserted back in the 50s. I'm speaking of the one here in the early 80s.
Right.
The civil war had broken out in Lebanon. The spark, I think, was that the Palestinian Liberation Organization had been kicked out of Jordan, moved into Lebanon, where they simply set up shop, meaning roadblocks, and they had moved to supplant the Lebanese armed forces and eventually the Lebanese government itself. The PLO in the late 70s was doing very much what Hezbollah has done now to Lebanon. The civil war started in 1975. It was apocalyptic. The city of Beirut consumed itself. It was surrounded by artillery pieces, shells raining down. I like to compare it to the last 15 minutes of Black Hawk Down pretty much every day.
Right.
The PLO was able to use this chaos in order to launch an unremitting series of attacks on Israel, which borders Lebanon to the south. Eventually, the Israelis invaded Lebanon. They came up the coastal highways across the Latanya River. They occupied most of Beirut, about half of Beirut, and into the Shouf Mountains, slightly to the west. There was a massacre that occurred during the Israeli occupation. There were two Palestinian refugee camps called Shabra and Shatila. Mm-hmm. It was determined that a Christian militia called the Falange crossed Israeli territory, entered these camps, and killed somewhere between 2 and 10,000 people in two nights of violence. It was one of the most horrendous massacres in the history of Lebanon, maybe one of the most horrendous massacres in the history of mankind. The 10,000 people who were killed, I think the number is more around 7,000. These were all unarmed combatants. They were Palestinian refugees, old men, women, and children. During the massacre, the Israelis fired flares over the camps so that the Christian militias could see what they were doing. This event, although it's not very much noted in the United States, had a galvanizing effect on Arab opinion and on the opinion of a 26-year-old Saudi college dropout named Osama bin Laden. He had attended school briefly in Beirut. His mother was from a coastal town just north of there. Bin Laden watched on television as the skyscrapers in Beirut belched smoke, and he made the determination that he was going to bring the same sorts of horror to the United States, which he would do in about 20 years. But this is the scene into which the Iranian government decided that it was going to send two truck bombs into Beirut, and they were going to strike at the headquarters of the French Foreign Legion, which was part of the peacekeeping force, and strike at the American headquarters, which was in a building adjoining the Beirut airport. Those bombs went off within 30 seconds of each other on the morning of October 23, 1983. My SEAL team, we were in a bunker about 300 yards away. We survived the blast. We worked with the FBI forensics units who came to investigate the blast afterwards. It was one of the FBI bomb experts who told me that this was the largest non-nuclear explosion in history of warfare. It nearly vaporized a five-story concrete building. We've all seen the Oklahoma Towers bombing, what was left of that building, and we've all seen what was left of the Khobar Towers building. In the case of the Marine headquarters, there was almost nothing left at all, powder. A similar bomb was detonated next to the French headquarters, but the French opened fire on the truck about 100 yards away. It still destroyed their building. There was an interesting case. This is often thought of as the first opening salvo in the global war on terror. Another odd little bit of history. More United States Marines died in Beirut, Lebanon, than in Khe Sanh during the Vietnam War.
Wow.
In addition to the bombing, there was almost daily combat thereafter in the streets of Beirut, often involving the Marines. The other things that have emerged since the bombing is that the National Security Agency actually intercepted the Iranian radio messages that ordered and orchestrated and executed this bombing. It kept those intercepts secret during the congressional inquiry, which blamed Colonel Timothy Garrity, the Marine commander in Beirut, blamed him for not protecting his troops. Although Tim Garrity, who is a friend of mine now, was on the record as continually asking for tank traps, cement, barricades. He asked to reroute roads, etc., to protect his Marines. Those requests were refused. Then this message was kept secret during the trial. And one of the reasons it was kept secret is because the National Security Agency, although it had intercepted the traffic, it did not decode it until 2 weeks after the bombing. The other sort of shocking thing is that the United States never made any move to hold Iran accountable for the murder of these Marines. As a result of that, Iranian complicity, attacks on Americans continued. They were responsible for the Khobar Tower bombings, and they have been responsible for several other acts of terrorism within the Middle East. And they are so good at it that it might be said that special operations suicide truck bombings are almost a strategic weapon for the Iranian Republic.
Mm-hmm. And of course, as you explained on page 82, it is one of the ironies of history that the most emblematic weapon of Islamic terrorism, the truck bomb, was invented not by a Muslim fundamentalist, but by a radical Jew.
Well, that's correct. It's Menachem Begin who gets the credit for inventing the truck bomb. He loaded explosives into a truck that was parked in front of the King David Hotel in what was then the British Mandate of Palestine in 1948. It was not a suicide bombing in that the driver did not detonate the vehicle, but the truck was left in front of the hotel, which contained the British command elements. Some hand grenades were thrown moments before the truck bomb was parked in order to gather a crowd. And when the crowd was at its height, he set the bomb off, which destroyed most of the headquarters building and killed hundreds of people. And again, it's a bit fascinating that there seems to be enough hatred and blame to go around on both sides. Regarding Shabir and Shatila, what set off Osama bin Laden was the fact that a Christian militia had been able to pass through Israeli-occupied territory, and apparently with the complicity of the Israeli army, to commit this atrocity. Israeli investigations themselves found that the defense minister, Ariel Sharon, was not just complicit, but responsible for the massacre. Ariel Sharon, as we all know, went on to become prime minister of Israel.
Right.
So there is enough blood on enough people's hands there that I find it sometimes impossible to take sides. Although I've spent a great deal of my adult life fighting terrorism, and I will continue to do so. The only way to stop this stuff, I think, is to expose its motive and expose its horrific methodology.
Now, you, of course, still work in the area of counterterrorism. I don't know if you're familiar with that book by Timothy Naftali about the history of U.S. counterterrorism. I think it was called Blind Spot.
Yes, I have read it, yes. Pretty good book, actually.
Yeah, great book. I think Naftali is the director of the Richard Nixon Library out in Yorba Linda, California now, if he still is. But what I picked up from that book was that prior to the 1967 war, the Israeli-Arab 1967 war, prior to that, the terrorism that existed in the United States was Puerto Rican terrorism. And it was only after Israel invaded these particular areas of the Middle East and changed the borders, that's what really got the Palestinians going, because the world community, for some reason, couldn't say, hey, get back to where you were, agreed upon borders. They said, no, we're staying here. And that's really what started terrorism in the U.S. Is that something that you would agree with?
Well, I would. I think that the Puerto Rican terrorism did continue through the United States with the help of the Cuban DGI. Cuban Intelligence Service has always been sympathetic and complicit to those radical Puerto Rican elements. After 1967, there was the political climate. There was, of course, the geopolitical realities on the ground, and also the rise of Yasser Arafat as someone who was able to pull together Palestinians with vastly different expectations, political orientations, and willingness to use violence. You know, Arafat was really an amazing person in history. He was able to form an umbrella organization under which he had almost a dozen Palestinian nationalist and radical organizations that were like keys on a piano for him, and he could manipulate them at will. For example, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine under George Habash, who was a Christian, an avowed Marxist, an extreme radical. He was able to carry out some of the most vicious terrorist attacks, and Arafat could always maintain some degree of plausible deniability.
Mm-hmm.
However, he was the conductor of this symphony of violence, which, as you know, from the late 60s all through the 70s and into the 80s, the primary threat worldwide was Palestinian terror, hijacking airlines, assassinations, the massacre at the Munich Olympic Games. There was almost no level that these guys weren't able to go to. They were also able to carry out some very sophisticated attacks. For example, Dawson's Field, where they were able to hijack 5 airliners at once, converge them in from around the world, hold a press conference, and blow the airliners up on live television. There was a lot that they were able to do. One of the things that helped them is the secret services of the Soviet Union and the Soviet satellite countries, which gave these guys sanctuary, explosives, and training, as well as travel documents, which permitted them for almost 20 years to conduct a global campaign of terror.
The great game. And Arafat wasn't even a Palestinian, right?
No, he was an Egyptian. His parents were Palestinian. He was himself an Egyptian.
Right. Did these guys, and do they have a beef against what's happened to them vis-a-vis Israel?
Well, I think they do. It's going to be hard to conceptualize the history of the Middle East, but there were 2 treaties, 2 diplomatic documents that have affected us down through the present day. The first was an agreement called Sykes-Picot, which was a secret treaty signed between the French and the British in around 1916. World War I was still going on. Of course, that was fought between what we consider the Allies and the Central Powers, which were Germany and Austria, but they were joined by Turkey. The French and the British were looking forward to the end of the war and dividing up the spoils. Sykes-Picot specifically dealt with the Middle East. It created the boundaries of every country that we now call the Middle East.
Right.
For example, the French wanted a foothold on the Mediterranean, and they got the nation of Lebanon, which was deliberately created to be a bit of a basket case so they might rule it. In the case of Lebanon, you have Druze, Alawites, Sunnis, Shias, and Christians all packed into a nation the size of Connecticut. The British wanted oil, so they created a nation out of Mesopotamia, and they called it Iraq. It had Kurds in the north, Sunnis in the middle, and Shias in the south, and it, of course, had valuable oil, which the Royal Navy needed. Sykes-Picot also determined zones of influence, that the French would have a zone of influence over something that we now call Syria, and the British would have influence over something which was then called Palestine, now called Israel, and an area then called Transjordan, now called Jordan. These countries were literally drawn up in grease pencil on a map in a secret treaty.
Right.
After the war, the Turkish Empire, Ottoman Empire, collapsed. The French and British were able to impose those grease lines, turn them into real countries. But every one of those countries, highly unstable, just taking Lebanon as an example. Now add to this, the British were on the ground carrying out a mandate in Palestine. In 1948, Jewish immigration had reached high pitch. The Jewish nation was formed during their War of Independence, as they call it, in 1948. But since then, the Zionist state has expanded in several leaps and bounds. In 1967, they won the Gaza Strip, much of the Sinai Peninsula, and the Golan Heights. There have been several wars fought in addition to that. In 1973, the Egyptians invaded, came very close to wiping out the Israelis. In 1982, the Israelis invaded Lebanon. Again, in 2003, I believe they invaded Lebanon again. This is an ongoing problem here, and it is compounded by the fact that the Israeli nation has never talked seriously to the Palestinian diaspora about allowing the almost 2 million dispossessed Palestinians to return to their property, which they have left during the 1948 war, the 1967 war, the 1973 war, the 1982 war. So you can see that there is intransigence on one side, there is terrorism on the other. That problem, the Israeli-Palestinian problem, is the mainspring to the clockwork of trouble in the Middle East. It is the main mast on which all these sails are hung. And it's an important problem, I think, for the world to be interested in. And it's in the best interest of America to help solve this problem justly for everyone.
Right. On page 130, you say that it is one of the ironies of history that Navy SEALs were deployed as counter-snipers to prevent the Israeli army from killing Arafat as he boarded a ferry for Larnaca, if I'm saying that right, Cyprus.
Right. When the Israelis had fought their way in the 1982 war all the way into Beirut, they had cornered what was left of the Palestinian Liberation Army in Beirut. The first American peacekeeping force in the 80s, I was part of the second one, was landed to facilitate the evacuation of the Palestinian Liberation Army to, among other places, Larnaca, Cyprus, also Latakia and Syria, Alexandria. They became boat people. There was a SEAL team landed to provide personal security for Yasser Arafat, again, counter-snipers to prevent the Israelis from killing him. Although I'll tell you, in the SEAL community, it was our kind of standard, a bit of a black joke, that we never thought the Israelis would take the opportunity to kill Yasser Arafat, because he was doing a very good job of keeping the Palestinians from becoming united.
Right.
That he was this master manipulator, and our sort of black humor was that the Israelis needed Arafat as much as he needed them. He did prove himself to be a survivor. Whether he was good or bad for the Palestinian people, I will let them judge themselves. But again, it's kind of strange what happens behind the scenes in history. It's not what people really would expect.
No, yeah. Absolutely.
You'd think that there's a SEAL platoon who has pledged their lives to guard one of the greatest terrorists who ever lived.
Exactly.
That's kind of strange. We call that good deals for good SEALs, so somebody wasn't really that good. And again, that wasn't my group. My group came after these guys.
Right. Now, I wanted to talk a bit about Osama bin Laden. One of the main things I noticed about Osama in your book was that the guy was kind of, well, he was almost like a Don Knotts type of character. I want to go through a couple of passages here. On page 104, you were talking about when the Soviets, of course, invaded Afghanistan, and that was a huge part of creating the situation that we're in today. But almost 5 years after the Soviets first invaded, Osama bin Laden made a trip to the battle area. Incredible as it seems, he had not gone earlier because he could not secure his mother's permission. That's true?
Yeah, that is true. When you're writing about the life of Osama, you have to realize that the things he wrote about himself weren't always true. He would later claim to have traveled to Pakistan the day after the Russian invasion, which categorically was not true. There is a case in examining his own writings that he didn't travel to Afghanistan for quite some time. And it was the events in Lebanon, almost more than the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, that radicalized him. Certainly the two things taken together were the things that sort of got him to move out of his very comfortable and protected life in Jeddah. He was very close to his mother. He lost his father at a very tender age, 10 or 11. He was much less the man of action, I think, than a Western mind might perceive. He grew up in very affluent circumstances. He was a bit of a spoiled child. He was the son of the fourth wife of Mohammed bin Laden, who had become a self-made billionaire construction magnate in Saudi Arabia. His mother remarried, grew up with some stepbrothers and sisters. When he went to college, for example, he was driven in a Mercedes-Benz. He had a very easy life. While he was at college and in prep school, he had teachers who were members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And this was where he was first exposed to the ideas of Salafist jihad. Salafism is a strain of Islam that seeks to reestablish the caliphate, reestablish Islam and Sharia law over the widest area of its conquest. Within 200 years after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, we're talking in 600 and 700 AD here, Islam has spread from Western China all through the Middle East, through Persia, through the Balkans, all through what we call the Middle East now, North Africa, all the way to the Atlantic and across the Straits of Gibraltar into Spain. You think of Spain and you think of its troubles now, you can see what the Salafists, why they would have any business in Spain. So a Salafist jihadi is one who has pledged to reestablish the rule of God over all this area.
Mm-hmm.
Bin Laden came into contact with these philosophies when he was a rather mediocre high school student and a not-so-great university student. These men had a great effect on his thinking, and I think it's fair to say that they saw in Bin Laden someone who could write checks. He was courted assiduously by these men and eventually cultivated by them. He finally found his way. Several years after the Soviets started their invasion, Mr. Bin Laden found himself in northern Pakistan running an outfit he called the Services Bureau, which was essentially a series of guest houses to facilitate, I'd almost say, adventure travel for rich members, at least paying members from the Gulf states, to come and experience jihad in Afghanistan against the Soviets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember reading about, on page 124, I said, geez, not bad. Those who made it through training, of course this is talking about the terrorists, would receive a salary of $1,000 a month, and married men would get an extra $500. Medical care was provided, as was a month of vacation. A month of vacation, and a round-trip ticket home once a year. So I could see why a lot of people would be attracted to going through terrorist training.
And those were the conditions for the men who were hand-selected for Al-Qaeda. When it was obvious that the Soviets were going to withdraw from Afghanistan, by that time, Osama had come into contact with Dr. Ayman Zawahiri, who is presently the head of Al-Qaeda. Dr. Zawahiri is a very interesting guy. He's an Egyptian physician. He was involved with the Muslim Brotherhood, and also involved in the assassination of Anwar Sadat. Zawahiri was arrested after the assassination. He was tortured in prison. He broke and informed against the Muslim Brotherhood. He was released for time served, wound his way into Saudi Arabia first, where he inveigled his way into the confidence of Osama bin Laden, and then into Pakistan. Ayman Zawahiri was one of the men who convinced bin Laden that the jihad should not just be waged against the Soviets, but against the West as well. Mr. bin Laden previously had been under the tutelage of a gentleman named Sheikh Azam, who was a Palestinian, a true romantic hero of the jihad, a military commander and an Islamic scholar, who was able to moderate Mr. bin Laden's terrorist desires and get him to concentrate on the war at hand, which was the war against the Soviets. Ayman Zawahiri was complicit in a car bomb explosion that killed Sheikh Azam. Once that moderating force was removed from bin Laden, it was Zawahiri principally that helped move bin Laden to now target the West and the West in general. Zawahiri is one of the co-signers of the documents founding Al-Qaeda and also shifting its target base to Christians, Crusaders, and Jews. But interestingly enough, Zawahiri preaches a heretic Islamic doctrine called Takfiri, which means that Dr. Zawahiri thinks that he can determine himself who is a good Muslim and who is not.
Right.
And in Dr. Zawahiri's mind, if you are not sufficiently Muslim, then you are an apostate and you too will be killed. It's all also a very ugly fact about Al-Qaeda, that the majority of its victims are neither Christian nor Jews nor Hindus, but Muslims.
Right. And civilians.
Al-Qaeda has killed more Muslims than any other faith. So again, you're dealing with, in the case of Dr. Zawahiri, I think, truly a psychopathic personality. Mr. bin Laden, jumping slightly ahead here, I think one of the reasons that Mr. bin Laden was able to be located finally by the United States was because he was betrayed by Amin Zawahiri, just as Zawahiri had betrayed the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, just as he had arranged for the murder of Sheikh Azam. 10 years after 9/11, Amin Zawahiri committed security breaches that allowed the Americans to find Osama bin Laden. And the prize that Zawahiri always had in mind were the hundreds of millions of dollars in funding still extant. The money, the booty from the Services Bureau, which is the money that finances all of Al-Qaeda's operations worldwide. And Zawahiri is in possession of that right now. And at least for now, he is the leader of Al-Qaeda as well.
And target number one, I guess.
He is target number one at this point, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to continue with Osama, because when I mentioned before the comparison of Osama to Don Knotts, what were you thinking? Did you agree with that?
Well, I really would. After the Services Bureau was established in Pakistan, Dr. Zawahiri had then inveigled himself into the entourage. It was Zawahiri who kept urging bin Laden forward into the battle area to fight the Russians. You know, this is kind of an odd thing to do with a guy who was supposed to be your commander-in-chief, your emir, and at least partially the source of all your operational capital. Bin Laden proved a staggeringly inept combat commander. I won't even go into a lot of it, but I will say that in one of his battles with the Russians, he actually, for some reason, climbed a tree during a firefight, which I can tell you, as a combat officer, is an almost lethal thing to do. He barely survived that. He was exhibiting, during his combat deployments, symptoms of Addison's disease. During one contact with the Russians, the story is that bin Laden was so calm that he took a nap. Well, the truth is that he passed out through lack of blood pressure.
Right.
There were some marginal successes, which the Al-Qaeda propaganda machine blew up into almost miraculous, God-willed victories over the Soviets. But one can't come away studying Mr. bin Laden versus the Soviets and Zawahiri without remembering that Zawahiri never put himself forward into combat, constantly urged Mr. bin Laden to do so, even after several defeats. And oddly enough, Dr. Zawahiri, who was trained at one of the best medical schools in the Middle East, continually and deliberately failed to recognize in his own patient low back pain, fainting, low blood pressure, and an incredible urge to eat table salt. These are all prima facie symptoms of Addison's disease. Yet Dr. Zawahiri never diagnosed it and never provided the simple medications to have treated it. It becomes increasingly obvious as you look at it that Zawahiri was putting bin Laden in harm's way. Also, Zawahiri had the sort of personality that he considered himself to be more highly educated than bin Laden, which is true. He had a medical degree and bin Laden had dropped out of his junior year in college. And that Zawahiri considered himself to be much more of a credible religious scholar than bin Laden, and that too is arguably the truth. It was Zawahiri who got bin Laden to form Al-Qaeda and to model it, oddly enough, on the Joint Special Operations Command. That what he wanted to do was find the best jihad fighters he could, the most highly motivated, religiously reliable, and operationally experienced men. Language capability was a very important asset, as were technical skills. These were the sorts of men that were put through testing camps in Pakistan and then higher order camps. This was the mechanism by which the 9/11 hijackers were selected and trained and dispatched into the West and again finally put on the path of 9/11. But these were special men that came into the possession of Al-Qaeda. They were literally as valuable as gold, because there were never any shortage of martyrs or people willing to join Al-Qaeda. But what they needed were people who were able to speak Western language, affect Western dress and manners, and move in Western society. The other thing is that if you have guys like this, and you have motivated them for jihad and martyrdom, told them the West is evil, given them the appropriate religious fervor, when you deploy them into the West and into Western culture, they become perishable commodities. They see things that are not so bad in the West. They see that there is tolerance in the West. They see that women are not treated as chattel. You put these guys in for a mission and you have to use them soon because they will go native, if you will.
Right.
And again, you see that's what happened with the 9/11 hijackers right before the mission. They were going to strip clubs, drinking whiskey, etc.
Right.
So that's one thing that operates against Al-Qaeda, that they're trying to sell an ideology that puts the world back in the 6th century A.D., and the great Satan is also the great seducer, and
right.
It's very difficult to get these guys to maintain their willingness to die.
Yeah, I guess maybe if the West didn't so blindly support Israel, that they probably wouldn't have much of a beef with the West then.
Well, I think that that Palestinian-Israel problem is the main circuit cable that runs through here. There's absolutely no question about it. I think, though, that what we've got now anyway is standalone terrorism. In Al-Qaeda's own estimation, they have two problems. They have the near enemy, which is not only the nation of Israel, but apostate governments, which previously were the Arab dictatorships, which we see now fluttering in the Arab summer as it goes on here into the Arab winter.
Mm-hmm.
And then the far enemy, which is the United States of America. We are a target to them, principally because of our support of Israel, but also because we are emblematic of a democratic nation. And Salafists hold that democracy is a religious crime, because the only government that they see as righteous and viable is Sharia law. Now, again, these guys are in the tiniest minority in Islam, but they are willing to act on their beliefs, and there is almost no check on the amount of violence that they are willing to bring to their solutions.
Right.
It's a multifaceted problem, but you are right. The Israel-Palestinian dimension of this is fundamental to the entire problem.
Right. And of course, the actual problem itself is the fact that Israel is an occupying force. It's not like the Palestinians did anything to Israel. Israel came into Palestinians' homeland and disrupted it and continued to disrupt it. So I think that's the issue. There isn't any Palestinian-Israeli conflict. The whole conflict is that these people, this country, they are an occupying force. And that's not possible to deny.
That is correct. After the 1948 War of Independence, almost 3 million Palestinians were dispossessed, set on the road, and thrown out of the country. They wound up in Syria and Lebanon, Jordan, all over the world, really. They have been trying to negotiate the law of return unsuccessfully with Israel ever since. This constitutes, on an individual basis, people who were dispossessed from land and building and possessions they lawfully held, and these things were taken away from them at bayonet point. There are generations now, 3 generations of families who are living in refugee camps with no progress whatsoever to get them back to the property that they once held. You've got 3 generations of unemployed people living in squalid refugee conditions. It's very easy to radicalize people like this and put them on the path to almost nihilistic violence. You've seen it throughout history. Hitler was able to create the thuggish Nazi apparatus out of the unemployed that resulted from the Versailles Treaty. We've seen Yasser Arafat able to recruit his murderers and terrorists out of the refugee camps in Lebanon and Syria. We've seen Al-Qaeda able to form its organization and recruit its murderers out of the unemployed, disillusioned youth of these Arab dictatorships throughout the world. The problem to be solved at its root, it is equality and social justice. There is almost never a military solution that can impose that. There has to be some justice here. It's an incredibly multifaceted and complex problem now, and these are all interdependent issues. I think that they are soluble without war. But there are some solutions in this that have to be kinetic solutions. There are some solutions that have to be diplomatic. There have to be cultural. But we need to, I think, influence states that are ostensibly our ally or claim to be. We need to get them to make these solutions, because 50 years have shown that the bitterness has not decreased, nor has the willingness of both sides to use violence.
Right.
And I think it's only going to get worse. It certainly hasn't shown in 50 years that it's going to get better.
No, and of course, a lot of very knowledgeable folks would pin that blame on the powerful Israel lobby that really has a lock on many of these, and some people think all U.S. politicians. If you don't toe the pro-Israel line, you're out. In fact, that was illustrated during these Republican debates. Seems like politicians can't agree on what to do to help America's own citizens, but they sure can agree that Israel's going to get $3 billion plus.
Well, you know, I'm not a politician, so I get to say not what people want to hear, but what I want to say. And there is a portion of the left in the United States that embraces Israel. There is a portion of the fundamental religious right that embraces Israel. Politicians in the United States are essentially lazy. They need to utilize organized groups. Both these groups on the left and the right are organized. They're able to tap into their constituencies. And to do so, they need simply not to want to enter in the complex understandings of the facts on the ground in the Middle East. I would hate to tell you this, but I think if we went onto the floor of Congress and held a pop quiz and asked what Sykes-Picot is, I wouldn't be surprised if only five guys knew the answer.
Or maybe one.
Or if 10 of them could tell me what the Balfour Declaration was.
Exactly.
It's much easier to simply say, this is our ally and we stand behind her. And that is wonderful. It's an odd thing to me when I hear an Israeli say, we are your only friend in the Middle East. Well, I might answer back, it's because you've made all the enemies we could ever accommodate.
Right.
I am not saying in any way to abandon the nation of Israel. But what I am saying is there is a lot more complexity and thoughtfulness and empathy that is needed in American Middle Eastern policy than politicians have shown themselves willing to put the effort to. At the same time, as a former SEAL commander, I can tell you there is only one way to engage terrorists, and that is to bring the battle home to them. The solution to these problems are always, the smallest portion is military, the second largest portion is diplomatic, but the largest portion is cultural and in the realm of civic action, that we should sort of try to right the wrongs as they are done to the individual persons. That's the only way that counterinsurgency or counterterrorism ever works.